back to the Neil Haley Show on the Total Celebrity segment, Caregiver Dave segment. I'm excited to welcome the program, Caregiver Dave. Dave, thanks for calling. I had to hear your whole life story, you two together, on when I was waiting to get the show started. But I'm glad you're on, and I know we have an amazing guest today.
Yes, we do, and he's so amazing. I'm going to let him introduce himself because he does a lot of things. He was writer for Love Boat and whatever, but Dennis Palumbo sounds like Columbo on the Inspector Columbo, right? Remember that back in the old days? So, Dennis, welcome to the show, and please tell us briefly, for those who've never heard of you, who you are and what you do and why you were put on this earth.
Oh, why? Oh, good. The meaning of life. Love those questions. My name is Dennis Palumbo. I am a former Hollywood TV writer and screenwriter. I wrote an episode of Love Boat. I was a staff writer on Welcome Back, Kotter. I co-wrote a film with Peter O'Toole called My Favorite Year. I had a fairly long and I was very lucky, a very, very solid career in show business. And then I went through some personal changes in my life, and I left show business, went back to school, and now I'm a psychologist. I've been in private practice for about 30 years. And my twin interests of writing and psychology have come together in that I write a series of mystery thrillers whose lead character is a psychologist. And like me, he was born and raised in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and went to Pitt. And the series of books takes place in Pittsburgh, my hometown. And that's what I've been doing. So while I still work as a therapist, I also write a series of mystery thrillers that take place in Pittsburgh.
Wow. So you're like you're writing about yourself in a fictional novel form, yes?
Well, yes, except that other than the fact that my hero, Daniel Rinaldi, and I both went to Pitt and both were born in Pittsburgh, he's brave and resourceful and can figure out crimes. I wouldn't do any of the dangerous stuff he does. Kirkus Reviews called him Jack Reacher with a psychology degree.
That's funny.
Now,
so
Dennis,
that's him. I'm myself a much more cowardly person than Daniel is.
Now, Dennis, when I was thinking about, you know, when you're writing a character and you're trying, you wish you could do some of these things your character, your alter ego could do, right, Dennis? In a lot of ways.
Well, the thing is, we do share some traits. I mean, we were both kind of mavericks in the clinical world. We're both suspicious about some of the aspects of the mental health system. And we're both humanists, you know. So I think we share sort of philosophical or value-laden ideas. But on the other hand, while my father was a grocer, Daniel Rinaldi's father was a beat cop. And the thing that I think makes Daniel also interesting is he's a former amateur boxer, which I'm not either. And so it's a nice counterpoint to the idea of therapists being sort of what was called soft males. He's a soft male in the sense that he's very empathic, but he's also stubborn and quick to anger. He has a lot of character flaws, and I think he drinks too much. So he's me exaggerated, and that part's fun. That part is fun, I must admit.
So have you always been a writer? And after you answer that, tell us some interesting stories with Welcome Back, Kotter. That was my favorite show. I was just a child, of course.
As a child, yes. I was a child when I was writing it, of course. No, actually, I've been a writer since I was, like, in high school. And I worked also for the school paper, when I was at Pitt. I've always been writing. I was very lucky. I got to work on Welcome Back, Kotter. I left Pittsburgh, came to California, and after, a significant struggle, but not too long, I was very, very lucky. I teamed up with another funny writer named Mark Evanier, and we ended up as writers and staff writers on Welcome Back, Kotter, which was really a fun show to work on. And when people ask me about the show, the thing I remember the most is when John Travolta used to come in, to do rehearsals, and he was always so tired. And we said, what are you so tired for? He said, every night I have to do 3 hours of dancing practice for this stupid movie I'm doing that I wish I could get out of. Then he comes in a couple weeks later with the poster, with him with the white suit from Saturday Night Fever. And we're all making fun of him and saying, oh, my God, this is going to end up in a video bin in about 2 minutes. What a disaster. What a mistake. And he would, yeah, I know, man. I wish I hadn't done it. And, of course, it becomes the biggest movie of the year. And overnight,
he becomes young enough to not turn it down.
Yeah, and it becomes the world's biggest movie star because between that and Grease, and he's such a nice guy, he kept saying, well, you know, don't write all the shows about me still. Let me just still be the same character I was. But the network would go, are you kidding? Welcome Back, Kotter has as one of its sweat hogs the world's biggest movie star. So, you know, I mean, he was like Tom Cruise for 2 years after.
Sure. Hey, are you the writer who thought of Up Your Nose with a Rubber Hose?
Me? No. That came from Gabe Kaplan's stand-up act. Many people don't know this, but the entire show, Welcome Back, originated from Gabe Kaplan, the star. His stand-up act as a comic, he talked about himself and his fellow sweat hogs and when they were kids. And that they used to make fun of each other with those kinds of phrases.
Wow. Yeah, that's
wow.
Brooklyn, all right.
Yeah,
yeah,
so when the show was developed.
How crazy was the set once he became a movie star? Because, again, let's talk about the show in certain ways, but then somebody that Gabe Kaplan probably thought he's the big star, then once Travolta star rose, was it crazy on the set once Travolta star went to where it was became?
Not really, because, you know, John's personality was pretty humble. And then after about half a season, by which point I had left the show, I'd gone on to start writing. In fact, the first movie I wrote was My Favorite Year with Peter O'Toole. And so I had gone away from the show. But from what I understand, when John went off to have a full-time movie career, they just brought another good-looking guy in to take his place. But I don't think he had John's inherent sweetness, which is what allowed people to like Barbarino, even though he was a skirt chaser and kind of full of himself. John's natural sweetness, I think, made people love that character.
So do you have some let me ask you another question. How crazy was the writing meetings when how many were you, and, you know, you're just throwing ideas back and forth? I mean, was it a very similar thing like I saw a documentary on the writers of Friends, how they just try to, you know, share what happened in their life. What was a typical writing meeting at Welcome Back, Kotter?
Well, I mean, we're talking 30 years ago in my former life, but it was pretty much like that. You know, you sit around the room and you tell stories about your own life and work together to what's called break a story, to structure how the episode's going to go. And you start pitching jokes, and you know, you always had to make sure you served all the characters, and especially the ones that had catchphrases. But it's funny, you're talking about a period of my life that's my old life. I mean, I was in my mid-20s when I was on that show, so that's many, many, many years ago.
Okay. Now, Dennis, you cracked me up when you say you're talking about my life. Everybody asks me questions about my pro wrestling days, Dennis, still today. And that's my old life. At 20 years old, just like you as a writer, I was getting my head bashed in as a professional wrestler in the minor leagues. And now as an entrepreneur and former teacher and owner of a tutoring consulting company in digital marketing, always people want to go back to wrestling days. I'm like, that's the old days. Let's talk about something else. So I can feel for you, Dennis, in those questions that come out from those days.
Alone, everybody asks me about Welcome Back, Kotter. They ask me about Love Boat. They often ask me about My Favorite Year because, you know, show business is more interesting than therapy to people who are not in the therapy world. To clinicians, therapy is interesting. I think the most interesting thing about me, to be honest, is the fact that I'm a therapist by day and a mystery writer by night. I think that's actually the most interesting part, and that my experience as a psychologist infuses the mystery stories so much. Plus, I like the fact that the books take place in Pittsburgh, which is a very different city than the one in which I grew up. You know, I used to work in the steel mills to put myself through college, and those steel mills are all gone. Pittsburgh's now a white-collar town and doesn't look at all the way most people imagine Pittsburgh to look. And my hero, because he comes from a blue-collar background like I do, I think what makes him interesting is he has a foot in both worlds. You know, he comes from this blue-collar background. His dad was a beat cop, and yet he's the first one in his family to ever go to college, to wear a jacket and tie, to be a professional. And that was true of me as well. And so I have like one foot in old world Italian-American Pittsburgh and one foot in the modern world, particularly as a therapist. So I think those resonances make my books, I think, interesting to people. When I talk to readers, they don't really care that much about the plot and everything. What they're excited about is the characters and the depiction of Pittsburgh.
Yes. And that's the thing that Dave has to understand is Pittsburghers are everywhere. They never stay in Pittsburgh. And it's one of those cities where they just wear it on their sleeve forever, Dennis, right?
So you if you go to watch a football game here, if the Steelers are playing, they're more terrible towels in the stands than there are the red shirts of whoever the opposing player is. There's a couple bars here in Los Angeles that are Steeler bars where you can go and watch every Steeler game on a Sunday. It's amazing. And Pittsburghers are all over the entertainment industry.
Brooklynites, too. Let's not leave that out.
Pardon me?
Brooklyn people as well.
Oh, of course, but that's a given. Everybody knows Brooklyn, New York people. But I think people would be surprised how many graduates of Carnegie Mellon in Pittsburgh.
Well, you know where you find all these people? At the hoagie sandwich places.
Yes,
we have a place out here in California that says the Great Western Steak and Hoagie Company, 3,000 miles to Philadelphia, eat here. And it's an amazing place.
Well, it's in Pittsburgh. You go to Primanti Brothers, you know, where they have the fries on the you can get a burger that actually has the fries and the coleslaw on the burger.
So what made you want to change your career from screenwriting to psychotherapist? Were you always a psychotherapist?
I had started, frankly, when my first marriage kind of fell apart. I went into therapy as a patient, and I fell in love with the process. So I just volunteering at psych hospitals and taking classes at night, not necessarily with the idea of changing my career, but the more I got into it, the more I realized I think I do want to make that change. And secondly, when I was in college, I had always wanted to be a novelist. So even though I had been pretty successful as a film and TV writer, I realized if I had a career as a therapist, in my spare time, I could write prose. And so it got me back into novel writing.
It's a great source of ideas and stories, I would think.
Well, yeah.
Keep them all anonymous, of course.
Yeah, of course, anonymous. And then plus, when I was at a psych hospital for 3 years, and, I worked with schizophrenics and people who were, you know, quite psychotic and delusional, and I learned so much about the human condition that I didn't know before.
You can't make some of that stuff up.
Well, yeah. The thing is, what I try to achieve in my mystery novels, and they're very scary and they have a lot of suspense, but I also try to illuminate, because the stories are told in the first person, the reader gets a sense of what it's like to be in a therapist's head. What's the therapist thinking? What does a psychologist think? How does he do it? And what goes through his mind when he's dealing with a difficult patient? And I think a lot of people are curious about stuff like that.
I'm interested to know your opinion of the state of the mental health of America 30 years ago, 40 years ago, and today. Oh, is it getting better? Is it getting worse? Is it the same?
Well, you know, it's so funny. It feels like it's going in two directions at once.
Really?
On the one hand, I think the acceptance of therapy and psychological issues having a big basis in people's behavior, I think that acceptance has really, really grown. On the other hand, there's still a great deal of fear and suspicion about therapy itself, that it can be coercive or manipulative, or people that go into therapy, you know, they end up, just arguing about what a terrible mother they had, you know. So
or something goes in your file and now you're marked for life.
And now you're marked for life. So especially in TV and film, I think often because people have those fears, psychologists and psychiatrists, particularly males, are often presented as predators and evil and manipulative. And, you know, and frankly, none of us have our act together that much to do that to people. We just don't, you know. So that's the thing that's so interesting, that I also think, frankly, that the government itself needs to pay more attention to mental health issues, because there wouldn't be the big opioid crisis, frankly,
yes,
if there weren't such mental health issues.
And how do you fix that? I think it's you don't think more people are identified, but I think things are far worse. They're not looking at specifically enough. Truly, the state, I think more and more people think that they have issues just because they're not happy in life. Do you think that has something to do with it, or do you think it's more identification?
No, I think there's a lot of truth to what you say. You know, I mean, I don't want to go into like a socio-political rant here, but I think because, particularly in the West, we're told we should be gorgeous and rich and famous and...
Yeah.
Married to gorgeous supermodel, you know, we should be Tom Brady, essentially. Well, most of us are not. And so the dissatisfaction bleeds into a kind of self-contempt. And then it just gets acted out. I mean, it gets, you know, sent elsewhere, to other colors, to other races, to other sexes. I mean, I think that's one of the things happening today is this promise of being rich and famous and then falling so far short of that activates for a lot of people a feeling of worthlessness and shame. And, you know, Sartre said one time that the state of man is incomprehension and rage. And if you think about it, that's motivating a lot of our politics right now. Incomprehension about what's going on in the world and rage because somehow you're getting bypassed.
Exactly.
I think it has a lot to do with it. And it certainly has a lot to do with the opioid crisis, because people are essentially self-medicating.
And the guy in the news who the bomber now.
Oh yeah,
keeps on going.
It just
keeps on
going.
Now,
there have always been people
true.
Like him. There will always be people like him.
Yeah.
But
unless
it's
the setup, right? We're going to find out. We'll find out in a couple of weeks that was just a setup, and that person was thrown under the bus, and that really someone else did.
I'm not a conspiracy theorist. I have a suspicion this is the guy. He certainly fits any kind of profile. But who knows? You know, at the point now...
Hey, you're the psychoanalyst, right?
Well, you know, it's funny. The world feels so chaotic. You know, we were talking about mystery fiction. One of the reasons I think people like reading mystery novels is that the hero gets the bad guy at the end.
Yeah, the whodunit.
It's very clear, and order is restored in a way that in life it rarely seems to be.
Exactly.
Well said.
Sure.
Probably mention, because I like to mention this in interviews, when people say, gee, I guess you have a lot of readers in Pittsburgh, because the books take place in Pittsburgh, and
yeah.
I do, and people go, oh, you know, do you hear from them? I hear from so many people in Pittsburgh, but they never talk about the characters or the plot. All they do is complain that I get things about Pittsburgh wrong. They'll go like, wait a minute. You have your guy making a left turn on South Street at 5 in the afternoon. You can't make a left there. I mean, I had people complain about how I describe buildings, how people drive around, what roads they use. And it's gotten to the point now where before I send in a novel to my publisher, I call my friends in Pittsburgh and go, is the Heinz Hall still there? You know, because it's in
funny.
My book. And they'll go, oh, no, they marked that for demolition 2 years ago. Oh, okay, good. Because if I get the facts wrong, I get emails from people.
I'm sure Neil emailed you, too, about something like that.
Oh, I wouldn't be surprised. My favorite, though, is I got a really nice email from a city planner in Pittsburgh. And she said, look, I like your books, but, you know, my hero lives up in Mount Washington overlooking the Three Rivers. And she said, I have to tell you, as a city planner, the way you have your hero go home from his office in Oakland, to his house in Mount Washington is crazy. No one would go home that way. And so she sent me a description of what bridge he should take and what road he should use.
That's great. That's
and so
awesome.
From
you should put him on the payroll.
Oh, I gave her an acknowledgement in the fourth book. I said, I won't say her name, but I thanked her in the acknowledgement section for finally providing Daniel Rinaldi with the right way to go home. And that's the way he goes home now in the books.
Now, so you would say, did you think that Pittsburgh would take so much by talking about Pittsburgh, how many people were interested in this? Dennis, and when you were writing these books or you were rewriting them, just you really enjoy this, but you didn't understand that by choosing a theme like Pittsburgh, are we going to have a TV series at one point in time? You know how
Well, let me just say this.
Yeah.
That's being investigated right now. That may happen,
which
awesome. I'm very excited about. I chose Pittsburgh because it's my hometown and because I love it and because it's gone through such a renaissance in the last 30 years. That, you know, it's like I describe it in the book. It's a shot in a beer town that collided with the information age. And that's really the case. I mean, if you go downtown Pittsburgh, you see all these brand new buildings. And then two streets over, there's cobblestone streets that still have the streetcar tracks embedded in them from 60 years ago. So it's really a weird schism when you're in Pittsburgh. The old and the new are just bounced up against each other. So much.
Will steel ever come back the way coal has come back?
Well, I don't think coal has come back. Do you? It doesn't seem like it has.
In West Virginia, they're sure saying it has.
Well, I
maybe
know they're saying that.
Maybe it just hasn't been away too long.
In Pennsylvania, they're saying it hasn't. And I feel bad for a lot of the coal miners who are avoiding going to retraining seminars because they're waiting for coal to come back. They've strip mined a lot of that area. I don't know if there's much mineral wealth left there, but I know right now if you go to Pittsburgh downtown and you see steel being embedded to start a new structure, that steel was imported from Japan.
Mm.
That's the new Pittsburgh.
So your answer is no.
I think
it's
no,
Google,
but, you know,
man.
I'm not a city
it's
planner.
Google.
What do I know? Maybe
it's
coal
tech,
is coming back.
Tech,
I know
we're
there's
tech been... country. We're a tech city now, Dave. So Google has the big offices here. They were considering Pittsburgh for Google's headquarters. So don't give up on we're a tech industry now in Pittsburgh. So if you call it anything. So.
Oh, yeah. If you think about it, the state-of-the-art nanotechnology, the state-of-the-art medicine, and lately the state-of-the-art robotics, you know, the thing everyone's worried about is robots. That's all happening in Pittsburgh. I mean, this is really the hub of all that stuff.
Awesome. Well, Dave has a final question. We really went into a lot of different things. Dennis, you're a fantastic guest. But the one thing that we do in the Caregiver Dave segment is he has a caregiver question for you, Dennis. So go ahead,
yeah,
Dave.
So you're a psychotherapist, right? And I'm sure with 65.7 million caregivers out there, I'm sure you've come across a caregiver or two in your time. And you probably know that their biggest problem is they don't know how to put their needs first. What advice have you got for caregivers out there? Because, you know, I have a whole website devoted to that, caregiverdave.com. It's a membership site where caregivers can get support and be a part of a caring and loving community. So give me your spiel on what you've learned about caregivers and what advice you can give them.
Well, one of the issues that most caregivers struggle with is burnout. And one of the ways, I think, to avoid burnout is to ask yourself what your goals are as a therapist. Because your goal should be to help your patients by helping them find the tools to solve their own problems. It's when you take their problems home with you, when you need a couple that you're seeing, and if you need their marriage to work out, you'll burn out fast over the years if a bunch of couples don't succeed. It's that kind of example where you get very invested in the outcome of your patient's life. It's their life, and you can only do what you can do. And the more, I think we have a responsibility as therapists to do our very best for our patients and try to help them develop the tools they need to cope with life. Life is very hard, and to help them cope with it. But if your goal is that every patient who walks out the door is happy, you're going to burn out, because that's not possible, and it's not your job.
It's the old saying, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink it.
Well, there's no solution for life. So why should a therapist think he or she has the magic wand that has the solution for life?
Yeah, good point.
One of my old colleagues, an older man who'd been a therapist for 40-some years, he said, yeah, I think it's a success if my patient leaves sadder but wiser. Ha! I felt to myself, well, that's not setting the bar too high, but on the other hand, it's a way of life, you know? So that's what I think the big issue is the overinvestment in the outcome of the therapy for the therapist to be overinvested in it. And it's a fine line, because you have to care. You can't do this job if you don't care.
That's right.
But you can't care so much that you lose yourself. The other good thing is you got to have a lot of self-care. If there's stuff you like to do, like play sports or play, you know, go bowling, or in my case, watch football and write mystery novels. I think I'm a better therapist because I write mystery novels.
Yeah.
It's my hobby, you know, and as my wife says, you know,
it's your hobby. Yes.
Well, it's a cheaper, you know, some therapists play golf. I write mystery novels. You know, it's the hobby that you don't have to join an expensive country club to do.
And selfish should not be a dirty word to caregivers.
I don't think so. I think selfish itself is such a harsh, recriminating word. I would be more inclined to say self-care. I think if you don't look after the self, you're not going to be available.
Okay, that was weird. Noise. Dennis, best place we can find information on your work, where can we go?
I would go to my website, the cleverly named DennisColombo.com. That,
all right.
I feel like we're getting a little bit of a glitch here. DennisColombo.com, DennisPalumbo.com.
Well, Dennis, you're awesome. Pittsburgh, that I'm so glad you reached out to me, and I'm glad you came on the show, and we're going to put this out on my television show as well. We put the radio show out for celebrity stuff, but I think it's perfect for Bethel Park and YouTube and all that, so I'll update you on the process of getting it on there as well. So thanks again for calling, and thanks for coming on the show.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much, both of you, for having me on.
All right, take care, Dennis. See you later. Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye. You're listening to the Neil Haley Show. We'll be back in just a moment.